I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Three more American soldiers have died in Iraq in the last 24 hours, one in a gunfight, one by a bomb, and one shot in the neck at close range on the campus of Baghdad University. Since President Bush declared on May 1st that major combat in Iraq had ended, 30 American soldiers have been killed, from attacks by lone gunmen to assaults by groups of up to 50 resistance fighters. Scott Peterson is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor who's in Baghdad. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
Scott, you write that U.S. soldiers are now experiencing 13 armed contacts a day with resistance in Iraq. What's that doing to morale?
Well, it definitely is having a negative impact on morale. I think it's not a question of whether or not the U.S. military can handle this. They certainly have more firepower in Baghdad and elsewhere in Iraq than any of the forces or guerrillas that they're coming up against. But the bottom line is that for soldiers who are doing patrolling, it means that their alert level needs to be very, very high, and that really does make people very fatigued. I mean, I've spoken to soldiers who are talking about the difficulties they face, the types of fears that they are experiencing every single day when they go out on patrols, and you actually see it sometimes in their faces. If, for example, there's a Humvee or other vehicles stuck in traffic, and you see soldiers sitting there very nervously, kind of holding their pistols drawn, their M16s are ready to fire. I mean, they are nervous, and they know that in a lot of respects they are sitting ducks.
Now, troops for example, the 3rd Infantry Division, which roared up to Baghdad so quickly during the war itself, they expected to be home by now, right?
Well, that's right. And in fact, they were told at the outset of this war that their ticket home was through Baghdad. They expected to be going home a couple of weeks after Baghdad fell, which, of course, would have been in late April, the latest May. And since then, they have had two or three dates, which were meant to be exit dates for them, which have been put off. And, of course, for some of these soldiers, the remarkable thing is they were expecting, having played such a key role in the war, these were the units that carried out the Thunder Run, for example, in early April, when you had units storming into Baghdad, basically taking control of Baghdad. They were hoping to go home, have a victory parade, put on their ribbons, and feel good about themselves. But in the end, what they're found is that three months later, a quarter of a year, they are still kicking around in Iraq and of course, wondering what kind of reception they're going to have when they get home.
And, of course, still kicking around in the heads of many of these soldiers. It was a quick victory, but there was still a lot of carnage, and a lot of them are carrying around that psychological burden, too, right?
Well, that's right. I spoke to two chaplains who spoke about the impact of that on soldiers. I spoke also to a colonel who was involved in combat stress management about some of the problems that they were seeing. And there's no doubt about it that this is it's been a lengthy engagement. There have been a lot of surprises, a lot of things that people weren't expecting in terms of psychological impact. And so people are grappling with those kind of things. And, of course, the separation issues, the fact that so many of these soldiers now have been away for 10 months means that what you're seeing is issues that people are having with their marriages, relationships in some cases falling apart. And this isn't true for every single soldier out there, but there certainly are a lot of things creeping into people's minds here in Iraq.
Scott Peterson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson reports for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Baghdad. We turn now to Bob Killebrew, a former military planner who joins us from Newport News, Virginia. Welcome, Bob.
Good afternoon.
Well, Bob, as we just heard from Scott Peterson, an average of 13 attacks a day on U.S. troops at the moment in Iraq. What's your sense of where this is going?
Well, my sense is that we've entered the second phase of the war. The first phase was obviously the seizure of Baghdad. The new phase is the terms are being written by whoever it is coordinating these attacks. My sense is that we're settling in for a guerrilla campaign that's going to take us a while.
Well, Bob, just this morning, General Tommy Franks, soon to retire commander of military operations during the war in Iraq, Franks told ABC News this morning he didn't think more troops were needed right now in Iraq.
Well, I feel odd arguing with the man on the scene. But my sense is that we need to either maintain what we've got or increase the force level. And in any case, whether we maintain or increase, this is a real challenge for the United States. We've got nearly half of our army deployed now, And sooner or later, we're going to have to start thinking about sustaining that force and rotating it. This is a very, very tough time for decision makers in Washington.
Yeah. Now, we just heard a report on morale, so these troops are going to have to be brought out of there at some point. Do we have the troops to replace them, or do you start to dip into, say, National Guard?
My sense is, and the sense of some other people I talk to, is that we don't have enough force now to sustain at least the four divisions we have there in Iraq. My calculation is if we don't start calling up National Guard combat formations, and I might add that we've already got a fair number of National Guard support units already in the country, if we don't start calling up National Guard combat formations, the Army's going to start having serious problems about 2004 or 05.
So your sense is that this insurgency in Iraq, whether it's from former Ba'athists, disorganized, or whether something that's becoming more organized, is going to go on for how long?
It's hard to say. The important thing now is how quickly we can act to recapture the initiative from these people. You clearly have a resurgent Saddam movement in the country. You clearly have someone who can produce and transmit tapes to Al Jazeera, and you have the beginnings of what could be a serious problem. The question for us is, can we act now strategically and operationally fast enough to cut this off and regain the initiative?
Are you hearing enough of a sense of urgency from the higher reaches of the Bush administration about all this?
I'm hearing growing concern, but I'm not hearing a move toward action. I know that later this month they're going to discuss whether or not more force needs to go into the country, but I think now we're at a kind of a strategic turning point, and we either have to take this on as a full-scale war or we're going to be into this thing for a long, long time under conditions we don't like.
And, of course, there are political implications with a re-election campaign underway, full steam ahead in a few months, of an enlarging force or a larger National Guard presence in Iraq, yes?
Yeah, I reject Vietnam analogies to this. This is an entirely different situation, but there is one eerie political coincidence now. In 1964, Mr. McNamara was depressing news of needing more forces in Vietnam to enable President Johnson's reelection campaign. I really hope that this new situation in Iraq, this changing situation, this challenge, is not going to get caught up in election year politicking. You know, the troops are doing everything they can do right now. We've never had a finer army in the field. But the question of how to react to this challenge has got to be made politically. And the political atmosphere right now in Washington is moving very rapidly into election year fixation. And I just don't think, I don't know if Mr. Rumsfeld is willing to walk into the president and say, boss, we got to call up two National Guard divisions.
Bob Killebrew, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Colonel Bob Killebrew is a retired military planner.
A string of fires since late March in parts of Washington, D.C. and Prince George's County, Maryland, is presenting a daunting challenge to investigators there. All 22 incidents are similar. A home or apartment with people inside suddenly catches fire, usually between 4 and 5 a.m. So far, one woman has died, 7 people have been injured. Authorities say the fires appear to be the work of a serial arsonist, someone who works alone and makes a fast getaway. Joining us on the line now is Robert Duvall, Senior Fire Investigator for the National Fire Protection Association. Welcome, Robert.
Hello, Gail.
Robert, as far as we know, the series of fires that are being investigated actually began on March 25th, which makes you wonder, why has it taken so long for the rest of us to be hearing about it?
Well, the investigators have to determine a pattern or trends and patterns, and one or two fires based in a particular area don't make a trend or a pattern. So at times it takes several fires in a vicinity geographic area to begin to form a pattern where the arsonist appears to be targeting a specific area or a specific type of building or neighborhood.
Then how do you begin putting together the pieces of the puzzle?
Well, the investigators will go back and look at each individual incident and begin to look at the area itself, the type of building, the type of people living in that building, the method in which the fire was started, were materials used that were available, such as materials stored on a porch or up against a building, or were materials brought in, newspapers or trash, combustible materials, and how the fire was ignited. Was it something simple like a match or a lighter, or was it something more exotic, like a device with a time delay in which the arsonist has a chance to get out of the area before the fire is noticed? And they'll take all of these details and begin to develop a pattern and develop a profile on the person.
Is it your sense, though, that this is someone who really is not just after the excitement of seeing flames, but who really wants to hurt people?
It appears that way because of the targets. I mean, this person or persons is targeting occupied buildings in the middle of the night. So it's not a vandalism type thing, or it's not something just for the excitement, or maybe someone that wants to be a hero, such as assisting the fire department when they arrive or something like that.
And, of course, this has to be especially nerve-wracking to the people in these areas because just a few months ago, we all remember, they were dealing with a serial sniper. What are they doing to protect themselves now, and is there anything more they can do?
The people of the area, basically, you can be vigilant and look around your property or in the neighborhood to see if there are suspicious people or vehicles that are traveling in and out of the area that they don't appear to be from the area, or are they just cars or people on foot just going through the area. They can look around their particular properties and see if there's any combustible materials that are just left around up against the building or on a back porch or up against a garage or a shed on the property, and eliminate any opportunity that someone could have to ignite a fire up against a building or on a porch or something attached to the building like that. And just to be vigilant, a neighborhood crime watch or something like that could be on the lookout for suspicious people and in addition, looking at areas where the arsonist or arsonists could potentially use to ignite the fire.
Well, Robert, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Gail.
Robert Duvall is the senior fire investigator for the National Fire Protection Association. He joined us on the line from Quincy, Massachusetts.
Just ahead, our Washington Roundtable looks into why Africa has suddenly become so interesting to President Bush.
And later, some smart summer reading.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today.
It's here and now.
President Bush leaves for a five-nation trip to Africa today, the continent he described just 3 years ago during his campaign as important but not fitting into the national strategic interests of the United States. Well, a lot has changed since then to help propel Africa to the top of the presidential agenda, at least for this week. Terrorism, oil interests, civil war in Liberia. Joining us now to discuss the president's trip are this week's D.C. Roundtable guests. Carl Lubsdorf is the Washington bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Gail.
And Jack Farrell is the D.C. bureau chief and assistant managing editor of the Denver Post. Hello, Jack.
Hi.
Well, welcome to both of you. Obviously, let's start with Africa because President Bush is off on his trip. He's going to be visiting countries where there has been some political or economic success, Senegal, South Africa, Nigeria, Botswana, Uganda. It does make you wonder why the effort here to applaud the success stories when there are still so many places that are struggling.
Oh, I think this White House doesn't like bad news. It likes good news, and it likes good news stories. And the president, of course, has just unveiled a major AIDS initiative, and that's he's going to be talking about that at almost every stop. Plus, he's going to a country like Senegal, which is considered a democratic model for the rest of Africa, South Africa, which obviously has gone through important transitions over the last decade.
Is the feeling in D.C. right now that this is a sincere attempt to, some would say at long last, strengthen our commitment to Africa? Or is it an attempt to appear committed and perhaps show a softer face of American power?
I think he can have both. I think that we should not challenge the commitment here because even though the $15 billion is going to be slow coming, it is $15 billion. I think that 9/11 changed our view with Africa like it changed our view of everything else.
Carl, what's your sense of that?
You know, we shouldn't forget that there's a political aspect of this, too. The president has had a fairly conservative administration, and he's been at war, you know, in the Middle East. And so I think that going to Africa is one way to sort of show the more compassionate side of his compassionate conservatism. So I think there's a political agenda at work here, too. Let me say this also. The fact that the president has changed his views about the importance of Africa and of U.S. peacekeeping, it's not unusual for presidents to change their views. You know, his father campaigned and he was going to have a sterner policy towards the Soviet Union than Reagan and didn't do that. And President Clinton said he would have a different policy towards China. So presidents often change their views.
And Jack Farrell, how much of a factor is the Condi Rice and Colin Powell really pushing the president to start paying attention to Africa?
I think that there is an emotional commitment there that perhaps would not be there if it was a white male serving in those offices. I think that Condi was particularly eloquent last week before she went out there talking about how slavery is the great birth defect of this country. And it's very hard to turn a phrase that rings like that about something like slavery, of which so much has been said. But she is able to do it. And obviously, the president listens to these two people.
One thing that's very different, you know, President Clinton went to Africa several years ago, and he brought a lot of American business leaders with him and really was promoting U.S. business and U.S. trade with Africa. This president is not bringing that kind of a traveling crew with him, and I think there seems to be a lot less of that effort.
Let's talk for a moment about Liberia, because over the weekend we saw President Charles Taylor saying that, yes, he would step down. And now one of the big questions is whether U.S. troops should go into Liberia. In a time when American soldiers are being killed daily in Iraq, how likely is it that the president is going to want to commit troops to someplace as explosive as Liberia? Carl?
Well, he seems to be planning to commit a rather modest number of troops. You know, one of the things that the Republicans criticized President Clinton most for getting involved in problems around the world, and lo and behold, and stretching the U.S. military thin, and lo and behold, this president seems to be doing exactly the same thing. It's part of what comes with being the world's only remaining superpower, but there is a certain irony to this.
And, Jack, there are also Somalia still has to be in a lot of people's memories. It wasn't that long ago, 10 years, when we saw the American soldiers, 18 of them, killed and the body of one dragged through the streets.
Yeah, the sort of the scary thing about Somalia to me is not Liberia. It's worrying about Iraq. The assassination of this young kid over there over the weekend was particularly scary because it's just anybody with a revolver can sneak up to somebody, kill one of our soldiers, and disappear in a crowd very quickly.
It's interesting. There's an op-ed in the Washington Post this morning from Senator Lieberman, who, of course, was a strong supporter of the Iraq war and is running for president. And he says that the president needs to, you know, join with the other NATO countries in sending a larger force to Iraq, that we've just stretched much too thin.
Yeah, and of course the flip side there is that if you invite other people in, they want a seat at the table, and I think that may be why the administration is reluctant.
Let me get back to Liberia, if I may, for just a moment. Republican Senator John Warner said that Congress should vote before American troops are sent into Liberia, presumably even the modest number that you mentioned. Could President Bush be facing a revolt within his own party on this one?
I think that, Carl, tell me whether you agree. I think there's a lot of unease in the senior Republican ranks, particularly in the Senate, about losing a guy a day in Iraq. And I think that in other times, Liberia would have been a no-brainer. You know, 500 to 1,000 troops as part of a peacekeeping mission after something has been negotiated. We've done that many, many times. But right now it has a little bit more symbolism to it because we're feeling overstretched, because the reservist families and the reservists themselves are complaining out loud about signing up for perpetual duty overseas.
It's interesting because over the years when presidents do commit forces, as Jack said, usually Congress goes along. The only way they can stop it is they've got to pass a measure in both houses and survive a presidential veto, and you can't get that kind of a vote. But it is interesting that John Warner, who is basically a pro-administration Republican, would be expressing doubts about this.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Nice to be with you.
Carl Lubsdorf is Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, and Jack Farrell is D.C. Bureau Chief and Assistant Managing Editor of the Denver Post.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll talk to the man who gave the world the cell phone about what he's got up his sleeve this time.
And the Bad Plus, not your typical jazz trio. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, disappointing results for Mexican President Vicente Fox in a midterm election.
There is an enormous amount of disappointment with President Vicente Fox, in part because he promised so many changes. He almost promised a new Mexico.
And a summer reading list for when you're busy doing as little as possible.
There are certain books I find that you need a wintertime setting. You need to be curled up by the fire in a long block of time and a cup of tea or coffee. In this case, I've tried to choose books that they're so gripping that you can read 10 pages at a time.
These stories coming up, Here and Now. I'm Marianne Nichols. Despite the killing of three more American troops in Iraq in the last 24 hours, the White House says there's no need to increase the military presence in that country. The president's spokesman says President Bush is leaving any decisions of that nature to military leaders, and they've told him it's not yet necessary. The White House is also leaving open the possibility of getting NATO assistance. British Prime Minister Tony Blair is standing his ground, rejecting criticism over an Iraqi intelligence report. The report blasts Blair over intelligence documents he gave Parliament to convince them Britain should join the U.S. in attacking Saddam Hussein. Charles Kennedy is the leader of the Liberal Democrats in the House of Commons.
The only way we'll ever resolve these profoundly important issues is to have an independent judicial inquiry. Unlike this committee, that would have high-level access to all the individuals, all the information, including the Prime Minister himself.
Parliament says the documents gave too much emphasis to a claim Saddam Hussein could launch a biological attack in 45 minutes. President Bush has reportedly made no decision yet about sending U.S. troops to Liberia and is said to be awaiting evaluation from a team of American military experts who arrived earlier today in the capital of Monrovia. The White House is closely following reports that Liberian President Charles Taylor plans to step down and go into exile in Nigeria, considered to be the first step in achieving security in Liberia. The presidents of South Korea and China say they're picking up efforts to resolve tensions over North Korea's suspected nuclear weapons program. The two leaders met in Beijing today and say they agree on the importance of keeping nuclear weapons off the peninsula.
Death Row's a powerful man, his strength he knows not of. If and ever he shakes your hand, you better wear an iron glove. Yeah, better wear an iron glove.
Buddy Ebsen, best known for his role as Jed Clampett on the Beverly Hillbillies, has died. Ebsen began his career dancing on Broadway with his sister Vilma in the 1930s. After starring on the Beverly Hillbillies from 1962 to 71, Ebsen returned to TV as Detective Barnaby Jones. He declared he was the luckiest actor alive. Buddy Ebsen was 95. And in stocks today, the Dow is up 166 points at 92.36, the Nasdaq up 50 at 17.13.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is out today.
It's Here and Now.
Mexican President Vicente Fox and his conservative National Action Party suffered major setbacks yesterday as results are tallied from the country's midterm election. Fox's party lost seats in the lower house of Congress and gubernatorial seats in key areas such as Nuevo León, a wealthy industrial area where Fox and his party were once a stronghold, in a defeat some analysts said would be like George Bush losing Texas. This, by the way, is the first national election since Vicente Fox and his party swept into office 3 years ago, ousting the Institutional Revolutionary Party, PRI, who had been in power for the past 70 years. Well, joining us on the line is Ana Maria Salazar, a columnist and political analyst who hosts a nightly news program in Mexico City. Hi, Ana Maria.
Hi.
Let me ask you whether people are seeing this as really a referendum on Fox and the feeling that perhaps he has failed to deliver the reforms he promised?
I think it's a little bit of both. Clearly, there is an enormous amount of disappointment with President Vicente Fox, in part because he promised so many changes. He almost promised a new Mexico, and he hasn't been able to deliver. And in a sense, it's somewhat unfair for President Vicente Fox because it's only been 3 years. He just promised way too much. I think that was the first problem. Second problem, his party, PAN, Partido Acción Nacional, is a party that wasn't able to deliver not only with the candidates, but the message that they had was very poor, too. Third, I think there's another phenomena here, is that the party that lost the elections in the year 2000 came in with good candidates and a very strong message. But clearly, this is a tremendous loss for President Fox, and it's being interpreted, at least by the analysts in Mexico City, as a lame duck. It's going to be very rough times in the next 3 years.
And it's also interesting to note, Ana Maria, that 3 years ago there was a 60% voter turnout. Yesterday, only around 40%. Have people soured on voting and democracy so soon?
I interpret the very low vote as the quality of the candidates. I think the candidates presented by most of the parties were candidates that didn't inspire people to go out and vote, which I think is very unfortunate. And I believe that the parties are going to have to reassess not only their messages, but also the way they select their candidates.
Is there anything that Fox can do now to sort of salvage the situation in the next 3 years?
Well, he's going to have to change his cabinet, and it's going to have to be an urgent change. He also has to change the way he exercises leadership and exercise much more control over his team and over his secretaries. There's not very much he can do otherwise except find ways to improve his ability to negotiate with the other two powers, which is the PRD, which is the party of the left in Mexico, and this new party, which was the other surprise, it's the Verde Ecologista. It's they're called the Greens, and they basically are the young party in Mexico. They did very well. Their numbers increased by 100%, and they are now not only a viable party, but they're the party that basically are going to define who's the next president in Mexico. Why? Because whomever this Green Party allies with will provide sufficient votes in the year 2006 for the presidential elections. And they basically are now the power brokers in Mexico.
Ana Maria, thank you so much.
I was delighted.
Ana Maria Salazar is a columnist and political analyst. She joined us from Mexico City.
Well, another election thousands of miles away, but also a victory for the old guard in Kuwait this weekend. In the wake of the Iraq War, some in Kuwait expected liberalization. With the shadow of Saddam Hussein gone and issues of national security no longer necessarily overwhelming all others. Instead, in weekend parliamentary elections, Islamic traditionalists won in Kuwait, taking about half the 50-seat assembly, which strengthens the ruling al-Sabah royal family. So much for liberal hopes of women winning the right to vote, for one thing. Now, to discuss why a key U.S. ally in the Persian Gulf would move in the opposite direction from more westernized values, we're joined now by Merdad Balali, who's Reuters Kuwait correspondent. A surprising result, no?
Well, it was surprising. Nobody expected that it would turn out to be so good for the government. The liberals had campaigned for a freer society, and they had pushed for market reform and for gender equality. But they turned out to be the biggest loser. They had 9 seats in the outgoing parliament, and now they have about 4.
Why do you think this result was what it was?
First of all, it shows that Kuwait is a very traditional society with strong tribal roots. And Kuwaiti people are firmly religious, and they really trust the Islamists in this country. At the same time, the Islamists are doing a better job of providing services, and that's what they really care about most of all. Because of the difficult situation, the economy not being so good. So local services provided by charity groups play a big role.
So was this a victory for Islamic fundamentalists?
The kind of Islamists who came into parliament are kind of different. They're from tribes, Bedouin tribes. The hardcore Islamists, the militant Islam, both on the Sunni side and on the Shiite side, they lost seats.
Ah.
The winners are these tribal Islamists. They don't have a political agenda.
At the same time, Kuwait is, of course, very much allied with the United States. Is this in some degree a message to the West that Kuwait is determined to forge its own path and not become any more westernized than it already is?
Well, the thing is that most of the issues that were discussed in the campaign were internal. Foreign policy was not really on the platform of anybody. Kuwait government really runs the show, and this is not going to affect foreign policy, including toward the United States.
But it does suggest that Kuwaitis have no interest in things that are of great and compelling interest here in the West, such as the right for women to vote and other reforms.
That's exactly right. The Kuwaitis are strongly opposed to giving women the right to run for political office. Kuwaiti women are still don't have suffrage, and they're fighting for it. Some women were getting really bold and even tried to break into some polling station to vote, but they were driven back by security guards. And one more thing is that the Islamists in Kuwait are kind of worried about American call for change in the region, for liberal reform. They don't want any influence. They don't want to change in their traditional lifestyle.
Would it be safe to say that this is a vote that's likely to indicate where Kuwait's going to be for the foreseeable future if liberals were not able to win more of a voice in parliament in the wake of the Iraq war? It's unlikely that they will for some time, if ever.
Well, liberals are already retreating their cause. They have been pushing on the ruling family, on al-Sabah ruling family, to share power. And they were also pushing for some kind of liberal economic reform. And they're very pessimistic. They don't think it will come for years to come now.
Mehrdad Bilali, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mehrdad Bilali is Reuters correspondent in Kuwait.
Still to come, a summer reading list made up of books you won't be embarrassed to carry around.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's July, and what do you want? Ice cream! But you can't find a local ice cream store anywhere, and you don't want to wait till you get home for the half gallon in your freezer. Well, that shouldn't be a problem soon. You'll be able to get ice cream wherever and whenever you want it. That's because the Federal Trade Commission has approved Nestle's acquisition of Dreyer's Grand Ice Cream, putting Nestle in the same league as Unilever, the Anglo-Dutch company that's been the clear ice cream leader. So some say the merger has now paved the way for ice cream wars between the two food giants. Joining me on the line now is Jeff Smith. He is the global managing partner for Accenture's retail and consumer goods practice. Hi, Jeff.
Howdy. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Tell us, what does this mean for the ice cream industry?
At one level, it's an indicator of the increased consolidation of major brand companies. And that's a reaction to the way consumers have changed the way they purchase consumable products like ice cream.
How so?
Well, there's this big company called Walmart in Bentonville, Arkansas, that has transformed the retailing industry and, in extension, has also transformed those companies that supply retailers like the Unilevers and the Nestles.
Why has this not been an issue for them before? I mean, why now?
Ice cream as a category has been one that has not seen growth until the last several years. I think there's been a recognition that consumers are interested in new flavors and new tastes. There's also been, I think, quite a bit of packaging innovation in terms of creating single-serve and small-serve products. And the packaging innovations have all created the ability to allow a consumer to buy something other than the good old one-gallon or half-gallon brick or tub of ice cream that you had to take home and put in the freezer.
What do you think about this notion that someday ice cream will be as ubiquitous as Coca-Cola?
I think it's a stretch, but it's certainly a great aspiration if you're an ice cream manufacturer.
Jeff, what are the implications here in terms of the little guys, the regional ice cream makers, like Blue Bunny in Iowa and Blue Bonnet in Texas, and then there's Turkey Hill here in the Northeast? Are these people going to get squeezed out by this acquisition?
I actually don't think so, particularly the names you just mentioned, who have very, very strong regional brand franchises and a very strong core loyal group of consumers in their local markets. But I think the days where a regional operator could offer low-priced, call it generic type of ice cream and expect to compete on a price basis are probably long past. It's really going to be those that they're going to nurture the brand that they have and continue to differentiate through new flavors and through a high-quality emphasis, they're going to stick around.
And just one more question. You mentioned that we will be seeing some new products, new flavors, exotic things. Should we be looking for popcorn ice cream down the road somewhere?
I'll tell you, Gail, there's a lot of creativity and amazing fragments of interest in the consumer marketplace now around flavors. If you reflect on the fact that they've taken the Butterfinger and Nestle Crunch Bar franchises and have already licensed those as ice cream products with Dreyer's, consider all the other candy bars they make and the fact that those are basically all sitting in the queue ready to be licensed or now just basically brought into the product innovation cycle. The other thing I'd say is there are certainly ethnic tastes that are starting to come to the fore. And if you consider, for example, the growth of the Hispanic population in parts of the country, mango or papaya might be flavors we see coming to the market in those regions where those consumers are predominate.
Well, thanks very much, Jeff.
Yep, nice to talk with you.
Jeff Smith is Global Managing Partner for Accenture's Consumer Goods Practice. He spoke to us from Walloon Lake, Michigan.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Reading knows no one season, but in the summer there can be particular challenges. After all, it's a distracting time, downtime. Beaches and picnics and boating and cabins in the woods, all that relaxing. If you do find some time for reading, you kind of want to stay laid back, nothing too heavy, though the tricky part can be finding a book that's not so light and fluffy, it sort of vaporizes right in your hands and in your head. Well, Here and Now's literary critic Steve Almond is here to save the day and the season with a few suggestions for guilt-free summer reads. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you, Bill?
A guilt-free summer beach read. Such a thing?
Yes, let's hope. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I actually brought in three books that I think are terrific at that line between clever and stupid,
that fine line between clever and stupid.
Shallow and depth. You want to enjoy yourself and be able to read on the beach, and you know you're going to be more distracted in the summer. You're going to be outside. The weather's nice, but you don't want to feel like people are going to look in your book bag or when you pull out the Jackie Collins and say, oh, I see. You're one of those morons.
Right. So we have our pride.
I suppose the listeners have their pride. I dispensed with it a while ago. But these books are very wonderful, all of them. The first one I'm going to talk about is a book called Deep in the Shade of Paradise. It's by a wonderful writer named John Dufresne. And it is a sort of a retelling of A Midsummer Night's Dream in the sense that there's a wide and strange cast of characters in a little Louisiana city, or town, I should say, called Shiver de Freeze, population 375. It's centered around a wedding between, and the characters have wonderful names in this book, it's a wedding between Grisham Loudermilk and Ariane Thévenot. Unfortunately, or fortunately for the reader, there's another character, there's a couple of other love interests here, and one named Adlai Birdsong has fallen head over heels in love with Ariane just on the eve of the wedding. So I'm going to read a little passage, which is the first time that he meets her.
Great.
Adlai sensed a presence behind him. Perhaps a displacement of air caused by the entrance of the intruder had swirled toward him and tickled the hair at his neck. Adlai turned, and as he did, lightning flashed through the house. He beheld Ariane, dark eyes, pronounced cheekbones, her brown hair short, straight, burnished, her smile. This was the most placid, lovely, and graceful countenance he had ever seen. She wore a tan blouse, dungarees. She was shoeless. "You must be Adlai," she said. "You're Ariane." Adlai stood, pulled the chair away from the table for Ariane. She thanked him and sat. He poured a cup of coffee, handed her the little cow, and watched her lighten the coffee. He was transfixed. Love enters your life in only this way, unexpectedly and suddenly, while the rest of the world goes about its business, ignorant of your blessing.
Yeah, so that's beautifully written, but also kind of fun.
Yes, it's very poetic, and I should say that John Dufresne's writing is wonderfully innovative, so there are things in this book, like there's a passage where the author, who often intrudes on the fate of his characters, says, well, maybe the readers have a first love that they'd like to discuss. Oh. And then there's a blank page in the book that says, go ahead and write down that first love if you feel so inclined, and feel free to email it to me. So it's really a wonderfully playful book.
Deep in the Shade of Paradise by John Dufresne. What else you got?
I have got one of the most creepy and riveting, so sort of from the sublime to the ridiculous, or from the lovelorn to the murderous, a book called Mutiny on the Globe by the writer Thomas Farrell Heffernan. This is a nonfiction book. It's a true story, but it is a true story that is so crazy in its dimensions that it seems like it's untrue. I'm going to read a little passage from the introduction, and then I'll talk a little bit more about what it is actually about. I should say that the brief plot is that it's about a mutiny on a whaling ship back in the 19th century. And of course, it's most of the whalers were coming out of Nantucket. So Heffernan writes, and was there an Ahab among the Nantucket whalemen, someone who went to sea out of impulses so at odds with the spoken and unspoken morality of his little island that no one there would have conceived of such a soul? The following is a story of one man so led by fantastic impulses as to be creatively vicious and so immune to the promptings of conscience as to need a universe of which he was the sole occupant. It is also the story of a cowed and confused crew, maroon seamen turned native, and surviving by wits and luck, naval heroes, prostitution riots, and offended Hawaiian missionaries, and six men making a nearly impossible crossing of the Pacific in a disabled ship.
Mm-hmm. So, reminiscent of that book, and The Heart of the Sea.
Yes, absolutely. In this case, it's the most notorious, I think, mutiny in the history of whaling, certainly.
Yeah.
This character, Samuel Comstock, who's the person to whom Thomas Heffernan is referring, is a guy who literally set out on a whaling ship, and he knew that he wanted to foment a mutiny, lead the mutiny, brutally murder most of the officers on board, and then literally take over an island so that he could be the ruler of this island.
Sure.
The plan goes horribly awry. The sort of short blurb on this one, Bill, is think Captain Ahab meets Hannibal Lecter. It's absolutely riveting.
Yeah. Do you prefer nonfiction or fiction in the summer? It doesn't much matter.
If it's going to be nonfiction, the way I feel is that it should be a book like Mutiny on the Globe, where you are just pulled in from page one, and then you say, oh,
no heavy lifting.
No heavy lift. This really happened. So, and I should say that you can tell by the writing, it's quite beautifully written. So the events are, it has that sort of elevated 19th century vernacular to it. And so the events are pretty brutal, but the way it's told has this sort of strange and elegant formality to it. So the third book I want to talk about is, and I should mention that all these are in paperback because, after all, it's summer. You don't want to be schlepping around a hardback and so forth. You want to spend your money on suntan lotion and popsicles, so I've tried to choose out paperbacks. It's a novel called Making Scenes by a young novelist named Adrian Eisen. I'm just going to read the opening passage, and I should note that there is some adult content in the book, and not in this passage I'm going to read, so it's not necessarily for all readers. I announce that I am no longer accepting money from my family. I move to Chicago to an apartment with a small room, a small kitchen, and a closet big enough to put my mattress on the floor. I write a letter to my advisor, thanking him for all the honors student research money he finagled for me during the last 4 years, and P.S., I withdraw all my applications to graduate school. I want to play professional beach volleyball. The only thing I can find in the want ads that won't interfere with volleyball is modeling. When I call, they tell me to send some semi-nude snapshots, quote, because some girls are naturals and some need lots of training. On Friday, I take the L to my parents' house. After dinner and prayers for Shabbat, my parents try to convince me to take their money. I tell them that I'm going to model nude to pay my rent. Mom says I'm wasting my education and volleyball is a sport, not a job. Dad says to go to the upstairs living room and he'll take the pictures, but he thinks what I'm doing is wrong.
Sex not unknown in a summer beach read, but maybe of a slightly higher order here?
Or a slightly stranger order, anyway. The novel is really just the adventures of this character. And what I love about the book, and all these books, I should say, are fairly hypnotic. That is, they pass that threshold that you want in summer of not being distracted, of a book that is so compelling that you can read even 10 pages, go away, jump in the ocean, you know, put some suntan lotion on, whatever, and come back and feel equally gripped. There are certain books I find that you need a wintertime setting. You need to be curled up by the fire in a long block of time and a cup of tea or coffee. In this case, I've tried to choose books that they're so gripping that you can read 10 pages at a time. And this book certainly qualifies. Absolutely hypnotic.
Making Scenes, Adrian Eisen.
Yes.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Absolutely.
Your summer picks. Here and Now's literary correspondent, Steve Almond. Steve teaches creative writing at Boston College and is author of a book of short stories called My Life in Heavy Metal. Music you're listening to is The Bad Plus, with their, to put it mildly, reinterpretation of Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. The Bad Plus have been called the Foo Fighters of Jazz. They do mostly originals. We'll interview the trio tomorrow on Here and Now.
Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
You know, we always love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And for more information on the show, visit our website, here-now.org.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink Technical Computers.